Are we ready to wrap this and make things move? Okay, you guys awake? All right. I was going over the slides and realizing that we are going to be seriously behind starting next week. So we have a lot to cover. And of course, as I have complained before, this is normally a two-semester course and we're doing it one semester. So take it up with the dean or the president or anybody else you want to take it up with. Okay, so moving right along to the communicable attributes of God, moving along because we have to. Your textbook always begins with explanation and scriptural basis, attributes describing God's being. Now, these are communicable in the sense that we have some sense of this, even in our own lives. Spirituality. Some humans would deny that we are spirit, that we are only matter, and any sense of spirituality we have is somehow an illusion. But we have that in our being. The Bible asserts that we are spiritual beings, and in that sense, that's invisible. So it's another way of saying it is that we are more than the sum of our parts. You know, obviously, because when a person dies, they have all their parts, but they're dead. So you have to think, well, there's something else moving along there with that. There's more to us than simply our physical beings. Mental knowledge. Now, we have no omniscience, no pretension to omniscience. This is a great meditation sometime if you wish to to think about this for a second. Just 1 second. I have to fix something. Okay, there we go. I want to make sure you're seeing the right things. Okay, yeah. Okay, but you coming to the discussion of knowledge, it's a great meditation for us to contemplate the knowledge of God. And that's something that you can never finish doing, is to think about what there is to know in the universe or even in your world, what there is to know, and then to understand that God knows that, okay? That is the omniscience aspect, that God knows everything. That should bring great comfort to us as Christians, simply the fact that God does know everything when we don't know. So many things that we are worried about, that we are stressed about, is because we don't know. If you lived long enough, you've known you've had great fear over things, and those things tend to be very minor things. You know, just as Jesus said, you know, do not have anxiety for tomorrow. Today will keep you anxious enough, right? And to know that God knows the outcome. If you go through any kind of serious health concerns, or a loved one has a problem, or I've been unemployed, I've been broke, I've been not homeless, but working towards that direction. I've been very sick, and I've had that happen to loved ones. And just to understand that God knows that, and that it's in God's hands, is really an important thing of unspeakable comfort for the Christian. Of course, wisdom is knowledge, and knowledge applied. Don Carson calls wisdom actually skill. You might know a lot of things, but you have the skills to use those things. Yes, God has this wisdom. He will never do anything that is unwise or foolish. And we know that we have done things unwise things. And sometimes with the more knowledge we have, the better we are at being unwise. We can hurt ourselves in many new ways and hurt others in new ways that we didn't know we could do until we had gained certain knowledge. But God has wisdom. Truthfulness, which includes faithfulness. There's no lies in God. I mean, we tend to put our best foot forward. We tend to not want to say certain things or do certain things that might put us in a poor light. I know I've read resumes after resume after resume, and I see some really interesting things come across in resumes. You know, we tend to do that, bordering sometimes on being faithless and not telling the truth. So that's a third one that's fairly significant here. The moral attributes. And these are, again, things that we can experience ourselves, right? Or at least understand and recognize when they're present. The ones in yellow, I'm sorry, I didn't move the screen. Okay, just one second. There you go. Moral attributes of God, which is goodness, including mercy and grace. We say that someone is godly, we're speaking to somebody who exhibits usually these moral attributes. The lines that are in yellow are ones that are not in your textbook, but there's not a lot of explanation about that. You can go into a concordance study and look at those things and see how these things work, how these things are described in the Bible. But looking at, for instance, holiness, do a study of God's holiness and look at the Old Testament and how, you know, God chose to certain dietary restrictions and clothing restrictions and all kinds of things that we think may be odd today, because he wanted his people to experience holiness, to be holy as he is holy. So there's peace, got ahead of myself. So the holiness of God is found a lot of books. A great reference is R.C. Sproul has a book called The Holiness of God. But if it's not free, and when I say free, I mean almost nothing on Kindle or something like that. There's a show of hands. How many of you have a credit card? I want to borrow money. Okay, no, not really. Okay, if you can talk to your parents or caregiver or people who are funding your opulent lifestyle, whoever it is, if you could get on Kindle, and you don't need a Kindle reader. You know that? I don't have a Kindle reader. I have a computer, and then you can download it to smartphones. And they're free. Kindle readers, and sometimes there's free books on Kindle, but there's a lot of times Christian books for 99 cents on Kindle. Now that is amazing. But a guy named J.C. Riley, R-Y-L-E, okay? He wrote a book called The Holiness of God, or Holiness, I can't recall, Holiness. An amazing book. It speaks about God's holiness and our holiness. It's about 100 years old, okay? If you can't find it there on Kindle, you can find it free online. You can download that in a PDF somewhere. Is it the Wittenberg Project, or the, not the, what's the first printing press? Not Wittenberg, Gutenberg. Have you heard of the Gutenberg Project? Project Gutenberg. Okay, Project Gutenberg, Sam knows what it is. It's, Gutenberg was the first printing press. That put all the scribes out of business, right? Movable type, right? Okay, it wasn't the first printing press per se, but it's the first one with movable type. So Gutenberg project is to take all the classic books and put them on the internet. And they're in free, the public domain. So I think you get the works of Shakespeare, you can get everything for free. You can get a lot of good theology for free. You got more. You can download more than you could read in the rest of your life. All right, already there. Also, I'll have to find it for sure and give it to you. But there's also a Christian version of it called the Classics Ethereal Library. Ether as an E-T-H-E-R, Ethereal Library. And that also you can locate a lot of books that are free there, okay? But you can look at God's holiness in that book by Riley. You could almost make that a textbook, but it's a very easy read. And then it also has some excellent ideas for lessons if you want to do lessons from that. God's righteousness. We understand what righteousness or justice in the word, in the word group in the Greek in the New Testament is the same word group, righteousness or justice. And that has to be unpacked, especially in a day when everyone's talking about social justice. And what is so, I mean, all justice is in a sense social justice because it involves people. But Christians need to reclaim the language of social justice, because social justice today is generally seen in a Marxist category. If you listen to, you've heard of social justice warriors, most of the language is borrowed from Marx, not from Scripture, because it's a horizontal justice only between humans, and it completely ignores the vertical dimension of God's righteousness or justice. So that there's a lot of material on that I can point you to as well. God's jealousy. And people get bothered by that. Well, if God's jealous, how can that be that, you know, God would be jealous? Isn't that a bad thing? Tell you what, here's the jealousy. As a parent, if everything you did for your child was attributed by your child to another person, you would be jealous. And that would be a righteous jealousy. That would be a sense that, well, everything I am, I owe to my neighbor. And you know that's not true. You were the one that nurtured them and cared for them. There'd be a lot of hurt there. But a jealousy can be objective. Jealousy is when someone else is given the glory for what is not rightfully theirs, for what they did not do. So when we glorify God, we're giving Him the glory, as opposed to giving the glory to something else. Everything I am, I owe it to my DNA, or everything I am is something else. But when you fail to be thankful to God, so He says, I'm a jealous God. I will not share my glory. You will have no other gods before me. And idolatry is a major problem. It was a major problem in the ancient days. It is a major problem today when we look at other gods and we worship other gods. And idolatry is a huge problem in the church. And we sometimes forget that or don't speak to it that way and call it what it is. We think of idols as something an archaeologist dug up, some grotesque statuary, and think, well, there is an idol. We don't do that. But we have people make idols of anything that exists in the universe can be an idol. And it sometimes can be things that you are sort of invisible, like a relationship, or it could be a lust or a greed or a desire or a covetousness. All those things become idolatrous, and God's jealous about those things. God will not share His glory with those things. Jealousy is having wrath. And if you speak of the love of God without speaking of the wrath of God, you're not doing it right. You are not getting the full counsel of God. And I think we need to somehow get to where we understand that God's wrath is poured out against those who are enemies of God. And God has enemies. Every human being on earth who stands unredeemed stands as an enemy to God. That is that relationship with God. Do you have a relationship with God? Well, yes, I do. Is it a good one? Is it as a child, or is it as an enemy? But no one exists who does not have a relationship with God. So His wrath. And if you think about His love of God, you have to think about His anger. If God is perfect in everything He does, His wrath is not like any other kind of wrath. And it's, how wrathful is He? Well, enough to sacrifice His Son to help us avoid it. We need to remember that in the whole picture of judgment and wrath, that in one real sense, does God save us from hell, or does God save us from God? Okay. Does God save us from hell, or does He save us from Himself? Okay. That's just a thing to go with. Okay. I'll leave that with you. Attributes of purpose. Okay. He has will, including freedom. Okay, I'm going to skip down here on my notes. Oh, I have to give you the screen, sorry. Uh, Okay. Just give me a minute, people. Okay. I just lost my notes. Okay. Coming upon them. Okay. So he's speaking about God having a will. We understand that God has a will. If we want to speak about free will, I'll be speaking that later, but we know that we have a will, we have what we will do. Freedom is an attribute that we understand that God does whatever He pleases. There's nothing in creation that can stop God from doing His will. This is very closely related to power, and a power that we, you know, omnipotence. We don't understand God's power, but there's nothing that we can do to stop God from doing what He wants to do. So even that's you know, if you noticed in the Lord's Prayer, you know, the prayer is "Your will be done," right? Anytime we pray and we ask God to change circumstances, which He does. His will remains the same. It's His will that you pray. It's His will. It is His will that you submit to His will. Okay? That is His, that's His will in these things. So when we look at the God's freedom, nothing we can do will stop Him from doing what He has chosen to do. We can't really escape that idea. We know that I could set out today to do certain things, and that could be thwarted, right? If you take a look at Psalm 119. Psalm 119 says this, "Not to us, O Lord, not to us, but to Your name give glory, for the sake of Your steadfast love and Your faithfulness. Why should the nations say, 'Where is their God?' Our God is in the heavens. He does all that He pleases. Okay, their idols are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths but do not speak, eyes but do not see. They have ears but do not hear, noses but do not smell. They have hands but do not feel, feet but do not walk, and they do not make a sound in their throat. Those who make them become like them, so do all who trust in them." This comparison between idols, we'll just stop there at that verse 8. When you consider that there's a way of looking at it is saying this, there's God and then there's everything else, okay? There's God and everything that's not God, okay? So God and not God. God is free to do whatever He wishes because He's the creator of all things, whereas we are not able to do that. But we can understand that as a communicable attribute of God, even still. So that goes with, that's closely related to His omnipotence. And then some summary attributes, which are in your book, perfection, blessedness, beauty. And then I want to add to that glory. These are just kind of a catch-all for some of the attributes of God. Like I said, this today's presentation was an entire semester of graduate study, kind of condensed down into this. So you understand it's a very big subject, and this is, the course is an introduction. So there you have been formally introduced, and we can, and that's all I can do right now. So we'll move on to the next slide. Any questions or anything so far? You can email me your questions too. Like I said, I'll get sporadic screen time through the day. So if you have a question you want to come up with, or you need to come up with, Okay. So, just to go on to this, the Trinity, the Council of Nicaea, 325 and 381, for extra reading, see Nicaea Council of in Elwell. See, I am really excited that you have that dictionary. Of course, I'm a nerd anyway, but move this on here. The Council of Nicaea. If you read that in Elwell, I'm excited you have that dictionary. It's an amazing resource tool that I didn't have available to me when I was starting out. Do the extra readings in that if you see some words. There's some stuff in the glossary and Grudem as well. Also, I have an article on the website by Božidar Marinov. He was raised in Bulgaria, I think, and now he lives in Texas. He's a libertarian Christian. I do not agree with everything this guy writes, but he has an article called The Philok Cause, Why the West is West and the East is East. I think it should be clause, not cause. The Eastern and Western churches have split over that phrase, where the Holy Spirit proceedeth from the Father and the Son. Those three words, I mentioned that before. That is a Latin phrase, Philok, it means from the Son or of the Son. That is so important, and you've never heard of it. But what it does is it shows it's a correction against subordinationism. I'm going to give you a real nutshell kind of case. You probably don't know much about orthodoxy in the sense of Eastern Orthodoxy. If you go to Russia, there's the Russian Orthodox Church. There's the Greek Orthodox Church in Greece. There's Hungarian Orthodox, various Orthodox churches, and they have a very different approach to the world. And